Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Money for the Rest of the Personal Finance Show on money, how it works, how to invest it, how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein, and today is episode 160. It's titled, Why Ethical Consumption is a Myth. The home where we recently moved is an outdoor wood-burning pizza oven, hand-built by the previous owner. Over Memorial Day weekend, our daughter and one of our sons came over to help us prepare and cook our first pizzas in the oven. We realized we were missing two important tools, a laser thermometer to figure out if the inside temperature of the oven was sufficiently hot to cook the pizza, and a hatchet to split the hardwood used in the oven. We managed to still cook our pizzas. They turned out pretty good. And we did it by guessing at the oven temperature and using a Dall axe to split wood. My brother-in-law mentioned that he had gotten a laser thermometer at Harbor Freight Tools, which is a store here in our local community. In fact, they have over 700 stores around the country. I only know this because I looked it up after the fact. I'd never been to Harbor Freight. And my initial impulse was just to buy the stuff off Amazon, but I was trying to buy more local. So my son and daughter, we drove to the nearby Harbor Freight Tools store. And I admit, I had never really cared for this store, mainly because I didn't know much about it, but I didn't like how it looked. I've been by dozens of times, and I thought, frankly, it was ugly. It's a rectangular building with a blank steel and brick wall facing the street with no windows. The asphalt parking lot extends to the sidewalk with no landscape buffer, and the signage is red with large white letters and no logo. And I used to be on our local town's planning and zoning committee for about 8 years. And so I'm somewhat sensitive, more sensitive than many, with some of these architectural issues in terms of commercial buildings. But the lettering on the sign is just very, very plain. Seth Godin wrote that fonts are designed in a little tiny box. Fonts tell a story at the same time they deliver the letters you need to tell your story. In other words, there's a backstory. There's metadata when it comes to how a sign is written and the font selected. The story I was told, at least I interpreted every time I drove by Harbor Freight Tools and looked at their plain-looking sign, which turned out to be an antique olive Nord font. I looked that up. And the story was they did the bare minimum to get this enterprise going, that they were cheap. Now, I suspect others who see the sign see a completely different story, perhaps a discount tool outlet. But I didn't even know they sold tools. I just never considered stopping. I thought with a name like Harbor Freight Tools, they sold equipment to ship and move freight. I envisioned a store full of forklifts, and it had never occurred to me they might have tools until my brother-in-law mentioned they had a thermometer. So we went in. It was crowded, mostly with men, many of them holding advertising inserts and coupons. We quickly found a laser thermometer for $27.99, which my brother-in-law got his for free, so I figured it was a fair price. It's more than free. And then we stood in front of the axe and hatchet section. The hatchet prices seemed incredibly inexpensive. A 1.4 pound hatchet with a hickory wood handle was $12.99. It was made in India. And it seemed like it should cost more. And when I see something that seems to cost too little, my first thought is it must be poor quality. But it had a hickory wood handle, looked pretty high quality. The second thing I usually think of is, does this product's price reflect all of the cost? In other words, are there negative externalities such as environmental, societal, or other costs that are being borne by others instead of by the manufacturer, retailer, or consumer? In other words, are there corners being cut to keep prices down? In the case of the hatchet, I just didn't know. I never really thought about where hatchets were made, and I guess India seemed like a logical place, but I don't know how the workers were paid, and how could they deliver a hatchet for $14.99? But we decided to buy it, and then stood in amazement at the line at the cash register where men were sorting through dozens upon dozens of coupons to make their tool purchases. We didn't have a coupon, but apparently Harbor Freight Tool is known for their coupons. There was one gentleman, he had at least 50 coupons he was sorting through, and we chose a different line. Now, Harbor Freight's been around since 1977. It started as a mail order discount tool store by Eric Schmidt and his father, Alan, in North Hollywood, California. I don't know about their ethics. I don't know how they keep their products that cheap, but it's an example. There we were in a store. I like to think of myself as an ethical consumer, but I didn't know, and I bought anyway. There's a book titled The Myth of the Ethical Consumer by Timothy Devaney, Pat Auger, and Gianna Eckhart. And they believe that indeed, ethical consumption is a myth. They believe it's a myth, and they describe a myth as a form of heroic but uniquely unattainable role model. In other words, this standard is too high, we'll never be able to get to it. So there's a myth. And the reason why is what it means to be an ethical consumer. The Oxford English Dictionary defines ethical as relating to moral principles, morally correct. In other words, there's a clear line between right and wrong, good and bad. And when it comes to ethical consumption, we'll see there is not by any means a clear line in terms of, is this a right purchase or a wrong purchase? It's many, many shades of gray. Gianna Eckhart and Timothy Devaney also wrote an academic article along with their co-author, Russell Belk, that I'll refer to a lot in today's episode. And it was titled, Why Don't Consumers Consume Ethically? And you can get links to these show notes to these articles at moneyfortherestofus.com, or you can become a member of my free Insider's Guide, and I'll email those links to you weekly, along with a summary article and other valuable content. You can sign up for that at moneyfortherestofus.com on the homepage, or if you're a U.S.-based listener, just text the word INSIDER to the number 44222. They say in this academic article, what is generally considered to be ethical consumer behavior is in flux. Is it really good to boycott goods from China to protest unethical unemployment practices when they may result in fewer jobs for Chinese workers who have no employment alternative? And which is a great question. We're going to look at some quotes related to that later, but there is no clear-cut determination. The article goes on, consumer ethics should involve not only core values about social justice, morality, and just behavior, they should also be relatively easy to act upon given the choices available in the marketplace that align with ethical stances. And that's the crux of it. It's not easy to act upon ethical consumption because there's not always a clear-cut choice. The hatchet, is that an ethical hatchet or not? And we needed something to cut wood, so we bought it anyway. They go on in the article, even consumers without strong ethical convictions would like to think of themselves as good people. So doing the right thing in their consumption choices should be appealing. However, doing the right thing may mean paying more, expending more time and effort to find the right product, or doing without a popular brand. Therefore, consumers may choose to remain consciously or subconsciously ignorant of the labor conditions, environmental impacts, or intellectual property rights issues involved in the products they buy. This allows them to continue to see themselves as good people despite engaging in ostensibly unethical consumption behavior. There is a cost to being ethical, and it's a cost in terms of time, often in money, or even giving up social prestige. And we'll look at an example of all those later. There's a book by Charles Tilly, and it's called Why. And it talks about why we make the choices we make. And it talks about how we tell ourselves stories to justify our actions. So we're narrative-driven people as humans. And so we want superior stories. And superior stories simplify cause and effect. We want things to be good or bad, as opposed to shades of gray. And so we have these stories that simplify cause and effect, deal with a limited number of actors and actions, and omit or minimize errors. So what are some of the stories we tell ourselves to justify our purchases of items that may or may not be unethical? Well, the authors, Gianna Eckhard, Russell Belk, and Timothy DeVinny, they interviewed 20 consumers around the world. They were hour-long consumers. They were represented by 8 countries in Australia, China, Germany, India, Spain, Turkey, Sweden, and the United States. And they were presented with 3 different scenarios that addressed some consumer ethics situations. And one scenario involved purchasing counterfeit products. One involved purchasing a popular athletic shoe manufactured under conditions of worker exploitation. And the final scenario involved buying a product that is potentially harmful to the environment or that uses animal byproducts in animal testing. And as they did these interviews, they came up, there were 3 main types of stories or justification that consumers came up with. And the first is economic rationalization. The fact that we make a purchase based on the price and we feel like we don't want to pay that extra cost to try to buy something that is more ethical. We want to get the most value for our money. We feel like we can't afford it. And that's often the case. We had a discussion over Memorial Day with my sons, and we were talking about T-shirts. They like to wear T-shirts. And the question is, how much? And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that I'll link to. It was titled T-shirt. How much is a $415 men's T-shirt better than a $6 one? And you can buy $6 T-shirts, and you can buy $415 T-shirts. At what price point is it ethical? Or in terms of quality, or how much should you pay? And it's tough. And my son mentioned he would love to buy ethical T-shirts, but he doesn't have the money to do that. So he'll often buy them at Uniqlo, which was mentioned in the article. I actually ended up ordering him a couple T-shirts from a different brand, 316, that is based in New York, that ended up being about $40 per T-shirt. And we'll see how the quality is. But there were some Australians mentioned that were interviewed, and here's the quote from the article. Most Australians, this is from one of the interviewees, most Australians are concerned about price, not the labor issues. Morals stop at the pocketbook. People might say something, but if they were to make them, the athletic shoes in Australia, at twice the price, people would buy the foreign cheaper brand. Those blokes, the factory workers in Southeast Asia, are lucky to have a job. If they weren't making them there, these people would not have work. And so we often make the choices based on economic rationalization. We often justify our consumption choices and not expending the time, for example, to figure out if it's ethical or not, not paying the cost in terms of time. The reason is what they call institutional dependency. The idea that the government is responsible to ethically regulate products. And it gave some example of a Swedish interviewee that said, the government should protect the environment. Similarly, another Swede said, now we are part of Europe, so it's Europe's responsibility. The article said, among many German consumers, this lack of individual responsibility was revealed in what we call a traditionalist manner. That is, these informants felt the expected pattern of government protection absolved them of responsibility. They ask, why should they waste time thinking about such issues or changing their consumption patterns? For example, one German said that the situations presented in the scenarios are just the way things are. Another said, I cannot do anything about it, so why bother thinking about it? Another expressed this logic with a fairly typical, don't talk about things that don't concern you and you can do nothing about. Let me pause for a moment and share some words from this week's sponsors.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. In my professional life, I've seen how important it is to have quality candidates to interview so we could find the right hire. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/David. That's linkedin.com/David to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Quick math, the less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. With everything seeming to get more expensive these days, you need to find proven ways to cut cost and boost performance at the same time. And NetSuite can help with that. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/David. That's netsuite.com/David. netsuite.com/David.
A third story that consumers tell themselves to justify purchasing products that may be unethical is what the authors call developmental realism. That some unethical behaviors on the part of corporations must exist in order for macro-level economic development to occur, particularly in emerging market nations. An example of an interviewee in China said, normal, it's absolutely normal and natural since it's a market economy. Another respondent in China, to have exploitation of the workers is quite natural. This is the natural adoption of every business throughout the world. A young Chinese woman noted that most people know how Nike shoes are made. It's very normal. Some say it's a good thing. You will be laid off if you aren't oppressed by others. The boss gives money to you. The boss earns money, and then you have money. No one is hurt. Everyone has won. An example from an interview in India. What can we do? It has nothing to do with us. Some people earn well. Some countries are poor. That is business. It's cheap for them. Nike, if they try to do it in the U.S., they have to pay more. There's nothing wrong. If they have workers, if they, the workers, had no job, then how would it be? At least they have food to eat. And another Indian acquiesced that basically there are few opportunities to work. Therefore, they, the workers, are satisfied with whatever work they get. Something is better than nothing. Manufacturers take this as an opportunity to give them low wages. In this way, both manufacturers and labor benefit. It's intriguing that all those comments were from individuals in the developing world. And I thought about that. A listener, Noah, sent me a link to a podcast, Econ Talk, in which Russ Roberts, the host, interviewed Elizabeth Pape. And she's the founder of the women's clothing company, Elizabeth Suzanne. And they make all their clothes in the U.S., their higher price point. And they had this discussion. And one of Robert's points was exactly this economic realism developmental realism is how we put it, that this is what it takes, that there's no jobs there. And so they're willing to line up and take any job, even though the workers might not work in the best conditions. And that's just the way the world works. And I struggle with that. But then again, this is why this is not a black and white issue. This is why it's not clear right or wrong, because in fact, that there are jobs being provided. I'd like to think that companies, and I responded to Noah, that it seems to me that there's a happy medium somewhere, that we could pay a little more for shirts and then workers could have a better working conditions. Now, another reason, and this wasn't discussed in the article, that we don't make or think about ethical choices, it's just too complicated to figure out what is the right choice. And there was a recent article in the New York Times by Tatiana Schlossberg. It's titled, Fig Leaves Are Out, What to Wear to Be Kind to the Planet? And this gets back to materials, the cotton or wool. You know, what is the most environmentally friendly material to wear? And she says, buying less is the easiest way to make a difference. But when you do need new clothes, you will usually be choosing among four major types of fibers: oil-based synthetics, cotton, rayon, and wool. Their environmental trade-offs are so varied that a definitive ranking would be impossible. So she did the analysis, did the study, and found there wasn't a right answer, that cotton is the best, the most environmentally friendly product. And so that makes it a struggle when it's just, you don't know. It's just too complicated to figure out. And sometimes it's easier to let the government do it or let somebody else, because it's hard to figure out. There's just, and maybe there isn't even a right answer. And a final reason that we often, or a story we tell ourselves, or things that we do to justify perhaps purchasing something that may or may not be ethical, is fashion. What's fashionable? We might choose something because it's fashionable. And you see this a lot on YouTube, that many YouTubers talk about the hauls they do in terms of clothing, and they want to buy a bunch of clothes and buy the latest fashion and don't really think about any type of ethical considerations. But in the article I want to refer to now was by Lucy Kellaway, and it was in the Financial Times, and it was called, You Heard It Here First, Hold Fast to Your Antiques. She had some antiques, mahogany antiques, a desk and a table from her mother. And it was a Georgian demi-loon table in mahogany, so it was a darker brown. She put it up for auction. For 3 weeks, it didn't get a bid, and on the fourth week, it sold for £42. Not very much money for a mahogany antique. And she mentioned she went online and looked at IKEA, and for £55, you could buy an Alav table. She writes, it's not made of the finest wood by cabinet makers who learned marquetry during a 7-year apprenticeship, but of fiberboard and plastic, and you have to screw on the metal legs yourself. And she was dumbfounded because brown or darker furniture, mahogany furniture, is not fashionable right now. People are willing to pay for an inferior product that's lighter in color than pay for an antique. She goes on, I know that the consumer is supposed to be always right, but according to these relative prices, the consumer is behaving like a ninny. The continued unpopularity of brown furniture proves all those experts who talk about consumer behavior are talking rot. One of the biggest trends for the past few years is meant to be authenticity. We are meant to love things that are handmade, constructed from natural materials, which come with stories attached. There is nothing more authentic, handmade or natural, than a mahogany demi-loon table. And when it comes to stories, being 250 years old means you have collected a few. Yet we do not love these tables. We hate them. What consumers actually love and have always loved are things that are fashionable. No one values authenticity or stories in the abstract. We only like them if we can attach them to something that we already desire, because all of our friends desire it too. Actually, I have one other reason we don't buy ethically, and it often comes down to context or expediency. What's going on in the moment? What else is going on in our lives? I'm there to buy a hatchet. I need a hatchet at the time, and I bought it. I considered ethics, but at the end, I compromised. I just bought it because we wanted to make more pizza. We need to be able to chop wood. And so an example, there's a classic study. It's called the Good Samaritan Experiment. It was back in 1973 by Darley and Batson. And this actual experiment was mentioned in the book that ethical consumption is a myth. And in the experiment, the students were studying to be priests at a theological seminary. And they were asked to come to the university to give a lecture to students on the parable of the Good Samaritan. So when they arrived to give the lecture, the researcher indicated the lecture had been moved to another building and that the theologians had either 5 minutes, 15 minutes, or 30 minutes to get to the new location. And then as each theologian entered the building to give his or her lecture, an actor pretended to be ill and collapsed in the doorway. The research question was how many of the theologians on their way to give a lecture on the Good Samaritan stopped and hence lived the example described in the parable. What was amazing is the single biggest determinant of what the theologians did was how much time they had to get to the lecture. If they had less time, they would just walk by and not help. And if they had more time, then they were more likely to help. And so it depended on the context. And our buying choices or our actions often depend on our context. And if we're pressed for time, we might make a less ethical choice. So what do we do if ethical consumption doesn't really exist, that it's a myth, because we're telling ourselves stories, we're simplifying, and we often make justifications for our actions, or we can't get the information that we actually need, it's just too complicated, or we're not able to pay the cost or don't want to pay the cost in terms of time or money, it's a conundrum. All we can do is do our best. We can listen to the stories we are telling ourselves, try to understand them, try to get as much information as we can. Hopefully, it'll be easier to make these ethical choices. But we also have to recognize that it's not strict ethics. Ethics suggests there's an absolute right and wrong when it comes to our product choices. But often, there isn't. It's not black or white. It's gray. And so it takes context, judgment, and we just have to kind of muddle our way through, but definitely listen to the stories we are telling ourselves. Now, what is our justification for making this purchase? So at least we recognize why we're buying and the decision we're making, the decision to buy, and what our justification for making that particular purchase decision. Now, it's easier to say, well, just don't buy, but actually buying helps the economy. It helps the economy grow. We had the example recently that we've mentioned moved in this house. Well, it needs some painting done inside. And Laprelle, like her Idaho root says, we should do it ourselves. We shouldn't spend the money and hire a painter. And because that's how she grew up. You just did things yourself. But my view, and she agrees with me, is this is how we help the world move forward. We hire a painter because that's their business. And that allows them to go out and buy, hopefully, ethical products. But we have to spend. It's not as simple as I'm just not going to spend. We can be more careful with how we spend. We can hopefully, if we can afford it, spend higher quality so we're buying less but paying more. That is just as effective as paying less and buying more things. Better to buy higher quality so that it has less of a resource drain but can have just as large of impact on the economy. So we do our best, and that's what we can do. There's this high standard, this myth of the ethical consumer, the heroic ethical consumer that always makes the right choice. That doesn't exist, so we do our best, but at least listen to the stories we're telling ourselves and muddle our way through. So that's episode 160. Again, show notes are at moneyfortherestofus.com. Everything I've shared with you in this episode has been for general education only. I have not considered your specific risk profile. I have not provided investment advice, simply general education on money, investing in the economy. Have a great week.